It's good to be back. I enjoy going away for a little while, but it's always more fun coming home than when leaving. And I think all of you can agree with that. This morning, the text from Mark chapter 10 is a story that pretty much everyone who's read the Bible, read the story of Jesus, knows, the story of the rich young ruler. Here's a young man who has lived a very morally upright life. You will notice the commandments that Jesus said to him, rehearsed to him. Five of the six commandments, or five of the six of the Ten Commandments. That's really awkward to say. There are Ten Commandments. Did y'all know that in the Old Testament? Y'all knew that, didn't you? Six of them deal with man's relationship with man. Four of them deal with man's relationship with God. For those of you that were in my Sunday school class, sunburn, okay? That's my only excuse, all right? Anyway, Jesus goes over five of the Ten Commandments, and these five deal with man's relationship with man. Notice them. When the young man says to Jesus, "What must I do to have eternal life?" Jesus gives him these five commandments. He says, "Do not commit adultery." No problem, haven't done that. Do not murder. Hey, good, haven't done that either. Do not steal. Don't steal. Do not bear false witness. I don't lie. I don't lie under oath. I don't lie other times. Do not cheat, defraud. I don't do that. Honor your father and mother. Hey, I've got this. And he answered and said, "Teacher, all these I've kept from my youth. What lack I yet?" And Jesus says, "Do not covet." Now, he didn't say those words, did he? But he was referring to that commandment when he said, "Go and sell all that you have and give to the poor and come follow me and you'll have treasure in heaven." Here's a young man. Jesus knew what his problem was. Do not covet. Do not covet. He had great wealth and he put his trust in his wealth more than he put his trust in God, evidently, because he went away sorrowful. He did not follow Jesus. He would have followed him if Jesus had stopped with the five and said, "Hey, that's all. Well, then I'll just follow you. That way I can keep my Porsche, I can keep my airplane, and I can keep all my CD collection, and I can keep all the money in the bank, and I don't have to, yeah, I got it. This is great. This is easy. Follow Jesus, live morally upright, but just follow Jesus. That ought to be great." But he didn't stop with that. I find it interesting that Jesus didn't say anything about man's relationship with God. Did you notice that? In that story, he didn't refer to man's relationship to God. And the young man asked, "What do that I may inherit eternal life?" And Jesus says, "Well, let's get straight your relationship with man first. Then we'll worry about your relationship with God." There's a message here for us, folks, about getting right with our fellow man before we get right with God. How important is it to live a moral life in an evil and immoral world? Somebody says it goes without saying, but it can't, however, go without saying. When we do not say it, people forget and they become distracted by all the bright lights and the vivid colors and the beautiful packaging of the world. We can't say it goes without saying. No, we've got to say it. And we've got to say it over and over and over again. We must live a moral life. The value of living a moral life. That's what we're talking about this morning. The fact is, we live in a society today where men and women live together without marriage. In fact, men can marry men and women can marry women in our society today. This is the world we live in. We live in a world where drunkenness is looked upon as not all that bad. Where stealing and lying and cheating and adultery and fornication are looked upon as either being okay or at least they're tolerated. I was doing some research. Someone told me about a sign, and I was doing some research on the internet this week about a sign that was held up in Ferguson, Missouri, where a woman had a sign out there, And according to the report, the sign said, a mother should not have to be worried that her son is going to be shot while robbing a liquor store. What? He should not have to worry, she should not have to worry about her child being shot by the police while he's committing a crime. Of course, I did some checking on that. That's not what the sign said. The sign actually said a mother shouldn't have to be worried that her child is going to be shot by the police every time he leaves home. That's what the sign actually said. And someone in frustration had photoshopped the bottom of the sign on the internet and changed it to every time he robs a convenience store or a liquor store or something like that. And they were frustrated, and they admitted, they came forward and admitted, yeah, I changed the sign, but it was just, I'm so frustrated at how this world is going. And I can understand that. It is very frustrating. Why would anybody think it's okay to commit a crime and then not have to deal with the punishment for it? Why would anybody think that it's okay to break into a store or even during a riot to loot and think that the police have no right to stop you? Why would anybody think that way? But that's the way the world thinks. The world thinks I should not be held accountable. I should not be held responsible for what I say or what I do. The world thinks like that. Look at our political race right now. Oh my goodness. Both sides are as dirty as dogs. They're both just as dirty as dogs. You do have to be held accountable for what you say and what you do. It's pathetic. It's pathetic. This is the world we live in. I don't think either party should be proud of their candidate, just to be honest with you. I don't think either party should be. That's my opinion, for what it's worth. It's just shameful that people can do whatever they want to do and think it's okay and that they don't have to be responsible for it. The world we live in is not the world that it should be, where crime is becoming the norm, where the criminal is caught and the community cries out against the police. It seems strange that we have to talk about the value of living a moral life. It seems strange to me. But all you have to do is look around to see that we need to talk about it, and we don't need to just talk about it, we need to do it. We need to live a morally upright life, and we need to keep on talking about it. In every one of us, there's a tendency to yield to temptation. In every one of us, there's a tendency to give in when we see something we really want, when we see something that just seems so appealing to us. Why should I be denied this? Why should God stop me from having fun? Why should God stop me from doing what I want to do? Why, there's no harm in this. I don't see any harm in this. Why would God condemn me for doing this? There is within every single one of us that tendency to give in when it gets tough, to give in to immoral thoughts or words or actions. And a little leads to a lot. Did you hear what I said? Did you hear what I said? A little leads to a lot. It always does. It always does. Galatians 5:6 says, a little leaven leavens the whole lump. Anybody here is a cook that's ever used yeast? You don't use as much yeast as you use flour, do you? You just put a little bit in there. That's all it takes. And it does the job. And all it takes is a little bit of the world in the church to destroy the church. And all it takes is a little bit of world, little bit of the world in your heart to cost you heaven, to keep you from making it to your eternal reward. A little bit of the world in your heart, that's all it takes. And you can lose your soul. It's a scary thing, isn't it? Can you imagine your car running like it's supposed to when you've not changed the oil in 20,000 miles? Can you imagine that? 20,000. Some smart aleck says, well, it's a diesel engine. Hey, you don't change the oil for 20,000 miles, you think that car is going to run right? How about this one? You got a 6-cylinder engine and it's running on 4. Is it going to run right? Well, there's nothing wrong with my car. I got 4 running out of 6. That should be enough. Right. Try going up a hill. My sister-in-law has got the steepest driveway in the world down there in Birmingham. Oh, my, my. You start up that driveway, if your transmission is missing one cog, you ain't going to make it. Okay? You're going back down the hill and you're going to end up in the bottom of the river somewhere. Pitiful. How steep. You better have your engine running right or you're not going to be able to climb a steep hill. And you better have your heart right with God or you're not going to be able to handle the pressures that the world's going to throw at you. We cannot afford to have a little bit of that leaven in our heart or it will destroy us. One author wrote, this is a short little paragraph, listen carefully. One author wrote, a great many people live their life in misery. Inside they know what to do that is right, but they fail to do it. And consequently, the guilt is overwhelming. In time, without addressing the moral standard that the Lord's Word reveals to each of us, we become hardened, dead to those things of righteousness, having bought in lock, stock, and barrel the ways of Satan. I'll stop, we declare, tomorrow. That's how it happens. You let in a little bit of the world. Let in the way the world sees things just a little bit. And what's going to happen to your moral values? They're going to eventually go away. And what would never be allowed before, you will allow now. Because there is no anchor. There is no standard. Moral living is associated, folks, with happy living. If you're a morally upright person, you don't have to feel guilty. It's a happy life and a productive life. There are no regrets about what was not done that should have been done. There are no regrets about what was done that should not have been done. No regrets because we don't have to look behind us and try to figure out how to cover our tracks. What's the problem with a little white lie? Huh? What's the problem with a little white lie? Just a little one. Just a little lie. Get me out of trouble right now. You have to have a great memory. Did you know that? Listen to me, children. You've got to have a really, really good memory if you're going to lie. Do you know why? Because when you tell a lie, you have to remember that lie. You have to remember it very well. Don't forget it, because if you forget that lie, eventually you'll cross yourself up. You'll mess yourself up. So soon you'll have to tell another lie to protect this lie. And then you'll have to tell another lie to protect those two lies. And then you'll have to tell another lie to protect those three lies. And pretty soon you're just a liar. You're just a big fat liar. That's what happens. So you don't tell lies. You don't even tell little bitty lies. You tell the truth. You tell the truth. Adults, we don't need to forget that lesson. We teach our children, but we don't need to forget that lesson either. A little lie will destroy a pure heart. No, living for Christ is beneficial in this life, and it definitely has eternal consequences when life ends. John Barkus wrote this, if Christianity does not make a man happy, it does not make him anything at all. So this morning, let me ask, what is moral living? What is moral living? Is it 11 o'clock? Well, I guess we'll start this sermon tomorrow. No, I'm going to go ahead. I've already been starting. Oh, somebody's over here clapping. Yeah, stop that. What is moral living? Romans chapter 12, 1 and 2. I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. Some translations say your spiritual service. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. There are two primary actions in this passage. There is presentation and there is transformation. You present your body as a living sacrifice. Now this carries with it the idea under the old law, the law of Moses, a sacrifice was presented to the Lord. And it was done in a certain way. There were very specific laws under the law of Moses about how this was done. If you're going to offer a burnt offering to the Lord, you read Leviticus chapter 1 and chapter 2, And you can find the details of this. But here it is. It had to be a male. It had to be without blemish. You put your hand on the animal's head and you kill it. You kill it by slicing open its throat. You catch the blood in a pan. You give it to the high priest and his son and the other priests. They bring the blood and sprinkle it around the altar. Then you skin the animal. You cut it into the appropriate pieces. The priest then places the appropriate pieces on the altar, and all of it gets the other parts get washed and placed on the altar, and then it's burnt up. Burnt up. It's a burnt offering. It's burnt up. And it has to be done exactly like that. Why do you ladies go to so much trouble when you're going to have somebody over for a nice dinner? Why, those forks and knives and spoons, you don't just throw them on the plate like we guys do. No, 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 no. That napkin is folded, looks like a duck or a goose or a swan or something. And you lay that knife and just, you got to turn the blade to the right direction. And then the fork, and oh, and then there's the salad fork, and then there's the escargot fork, and then there's the dessert fork, and then there's the pear and the peach and the apple fork. And then there's all these little spoons and, oh my goodness gracious. Oh, and then there's the bread plate, and then there's the salad bowl, and then there's the dessert plate, and then there's the little coffee cup, the little coffee plate, and then there's the dinner plate, and then you put all the food on the plate, and you got it. And when you go to the fancy restaurant, how do they serve it? Oh my goodness. They get a duck, they cook it till it's down that little, put it on the plate, put an olive on it, and a little carrot here and a garnish here, little sprinkle of juice or salad, and there. And it's they say it's all about the presentation. It's all about the presentation. Forget the taste. It's all about the presentation. Do you know what that is, brethren? It's called giving attention to the details. God is big on the details, isn't he? He's big on the details. You want to offer a sacrifice? Don't bring strange fire. Nadab and Abihu found that out. You say you've sold your land, you're giving the money to the Lord. Don't pretend you're giving it all when you're keeping part of it back. Ananias and Sapphira found that out. Uzzah was a sincere man who was trying to do what's right. He was trying to protect the Ark of the Covenant, which was being carried on this ox cart. Was it being transported like it's supposed to? No, sir. Supposed to be priests with poles on their shoulders carrying that thing like this. And if one stumbles, there's others to hold it up. But no, sir. An ox stumbles, the Ark of the Covenant begins to tumble off the cart. He steadies it, and he's struck dead for it. God gives attention to the details. To the details. We talk about living a moral life. You got to give attention to the details. That's presentation, folks. James 1:27 says, pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this, to visit the orphans and widows in their trouble and to keep oneself unspotted from the world. Keep oneself unspotted from the world. Attention to detail, brethren. It's presentation. Present your bodies as a living sacrifice. Second is transformation. Transformation. It's a change. A Christian is to consider that which the world offers and recognize that this is not something I need to be associated with. If this is what the world offers, and this is what God offers, I need to be smart. I need to choose that which is going to last. He goes through a transformation. And this is accomplished by spiritual education, by training ourselves to think a different way, to look at things a different way. We change the way we think. We no longer think like the world thinks. We become living sacrifices. Somebody said the problem with living sacrifice is it keeps crawling off the altar. Well, there you go. That's the humanity problem. We keep crawling off the altar. We're a living sacrifice, but we keep crawling off the altar. We need to stay in God's service. Stay faithful to God. And the way we do that is by living a moral life. Presentation, transformation, results in salvation. You present your body to God as a living sacrifice, and you're transformed in the way you think about things. The world's values are not your values anymore. The world's values are different than God's values. There are some passages that we would consider this morning, and then the lesson is yours. Titus 2:11-14, we're taught to look. For the grace of God that brings salvation has appeared to all men, but we just need to look for it. It teaches us that denying ungodliness and worldly lusts, we should live soberly, righteously, and godly in this present age. See? Looking for the blessed hope and glorious appearing of our great God and Savior Jesus Christ, who gave himself for us, that he might redeem us from every lawless deed, and what? And purify for himself moral living, moral uprightness, being truthful, being honest, being honorable, people of honor and integrity, that he might purify for himself his own special people, zealous for good works. Philippians 4 and 8, we're taught to think. Not only are we taught to look, as Titus 2 says, but Philippians 4 and 8 says we're taught to think. Finally, brethren, whatsoever things are true, or noble, or just, or pure, or lovely, or of good report, if there's any virtue, if there's any praise, think on these things. We're taught to think. We're taught to produce. Galatians 5, 22 through 24. But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Against such there is no law. And those who are Christ's have crucified the flesh with its passions and desires. We're not ruled by our desires. We rule over our desires. We rule over our desires. That's how a man can stay faithful to his wife. He's got to rule over his desires. Do you think that there's a man alive who's never desired another woman? Do you think there's a man alive who's married that has never looked at another woman and thought, wow? Do you think that? Wake up. Do you think, men, that there's a woman anywhere in the world that's married that's never seen another man and said, oh, if only my husband looked like that? Or if only my husband treated me like he treats his wife? You think there's a woman alive that's never done that? Wake up! Wake up! We need to realize that we are to practice self-control. We are to control and overcome our passions and desires. We rule them instead of letting them rule us. Do you know the difference between a 2-year-old and a 22-year-old? Somebody says, not much. Well, the reality is the difference between a 2-year-old and a 22-year-old is a 22-year-old hopefully has learned that he doesn't always get his own way. But a 2-year-old hadn't figured that out yet. That's why they call them the terrible twos. Because they haven't figured out that they don't control the world. They haven't figured out that the world doesn't bow to them and serve their every whim. So a 2-year-old, but a 22-year-old hopefully is learning, God is king and not me. We are to crucify the flesh with its passions and lust. Ephesians 6, 10 through 18, we're taught to protect. Not only are we taught to look or to think and to produce the fruit of the Spirit, but we're also taught to protect, to guard and defend. Watch this. Ephesians 6, 10 through 18. Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God. Armor is not an offensive weapon. Armor is to protect you. Take up the whole armor of God that you may be able to withstand in the evil day. And having done all to stand, stand therefore. You've done the protecting, now stand there. Stand up for Jesus. Stand for what's right. Stand for something. My mama loved Aaron Tippin. We were looking at a bunch of family pictures last night, and Aaron Tippin gave mama a big old hug. She was one of his biggest fans. Well, not all that big, but she sure was a fan. But he had a song, you got to stand for something or you'll fall for anything. That's the only song he ever did that I remember. You got to stand for something or you'll fall for anything. We've got to stand up for Jesus and stand for what's right or we're going to fall for anything. Having done all to stand, stand therefore, having girded your waist with truth, having put on the breastplate of righteousness, having shod your feet with the preparation of the gospel of peace, above all taking the shield of faith with which you will be able to quench all the fiery darts of the wicked one. Protect yourself from the rulings and the temptations and the pollutions of the world. Keep yourself unspotted from the world is what James says. That's what this whole armor is about. Take the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, which is the Word of God, praying always with all prayer and supplication in the Spirit, being watchful to the end with all perseverance and supplication for all the saints. Perseverance and supplication, prayers for all the saints. Pray for each other. Stand together. Stand strong. Stand tall. Stand for something or fall for everything. Stand. And finally, we're not to slack off. 2 Peter chapter 1, verses 5 through 8. These are all verses you know. These are all passages you're familiar with. Let's just hear them again. For this very reason, giving all diligence, add to your faith virtue, to virtue knowledge, to knowledge self-control, to self-control perseverance, to perseverance godliness, to godliness brotherly kindness, and to brotherly kindness love. For if these things are yours and abound, you will neither be barren nor unfruitful in the knowledge of our Lord Jesus Christ. You see what this is all about? Do you get the picture? Do you see what this is telling you? We have been given instructions to stand up for something, to live a moral life. We're taught to look. We're taught to think. We're taught to produce. We're taught to protect. And we're taught not to slack off, as 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 5 through 8 says. Now, there are benefits from living a moral life. And that's what we're talking about this morning, the value of a moral life. Benefits are simple. A moral life brings joy because it keeps us in God's care. It helps us avoid physical problems that would come to us. Lung cancer has passed breast cancer. By the way, October, I'm wearing these in honor of Judy, Tom. Okay? October is National Breast Cancer Awareness Month. And I want to let you know that lung cancer in women has passed breast cancer now as being the number one killer of women. The number one cancer killer of women is no longer breast cancer. It's moved to number two. It took some 30 or 40 years for lung cancer to catch up, but all the smoking, all the dipping, all the chewing, all the stuff that was done with tobacco, and all the ingredients to tobacco. See, I personally don't think it was tobacco that did this. I think it's the way it's made and all the ingredients they put in it. That's what I think. That's Robert's opinion. But all this stuff has finally caught up, and now lung cancer has taken over as the number one killer of women in the United States of America. Isn't that something? But see, you avoid a lot of physical problems by living a morally upright life. It encourages and helps us to be happy. It helps us to be free from guilt. It is setting a proper example. It is pleasing to the Lord, and it has the promise of living with the Lord in eternity. If you live a morally upright life, it is so easy to dedicate your life to serving God. It's so easy to do that. The value of being a Christian in this world is, it's not easily seen when looking through the world's eyes. When we look through eyes of desire and lust and covetousness, when we look through the eyes of jealousy over some other person's possessions or accomplishments or opportunities, and we don't have those, and we look at the world, we look at life through those eyes, it's hard for us to see the value of a morally upright life. Well, only the bad people prosper. The good people suffer, and the bad people prosper. And the bad people take advantage of the good people, and look at all the stuff they get, and look how hard it is to be a good person. When you're looking at life through the world's eyes, it's hard to see the value of morally upright living. But when we put on our spiritual glasses, and when we look at life through God's lenses, we can easily see that we're more blessed in this life than all the worldly people, and we have the promise of heaven too. The value of living a moral life, Jesus teaches us that we're to live godly and righteously in this present world. And He's calling on you to do that today. If you're not a Christian, you need to